listening to the podcast Between the Liminalist at horticulture.com, talking to Nicholas Hausdorff.
Jason, how are you?
All right. How are you doing?
Did you clean up your room?
No, I didn't. I just can't get around to it. I'm a useless failure.
That's it. Basically, you've said it yourself. There's no way back for you. No, how are you doing? It's getting warm in Canada, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And you're in. I can't keep track of you. You're a German who writes for the Hong Kong Review of Books and lives in
Melbourne.
Melbourne, yeah. I mean, that's really good.
Total degenerate nomad.
Yeah. Well, so no wonder you're interested in cultural analysis and comparisons and whatnot.
Yeah. Perhaps there's a deterministic aspect of just changing places, right? Mm.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, I'm similar, I suppose. I finally settled about time I turned 40, as it turned out. Wasn't consciously implemented. It was orchestrated by higher forces, and I I went along with that. And I'm still kind of slightly resentful, but nothing too serious. Yeah, becoming sedentary, I guess, is the term for it. Roots, putting down roots.
Yeah, that's healthy. That's a good thing to do.
Apparently. I mean, I wouldn't have believed it when I was 30, probably, or even when I was 40. But now, having done it, I think I would agree. Yeah, it's kind of all part of coming down to earth, that whole trajectory.
Yeah. But if you at the same time you can't become too sclerotic, especially if you like traveling, you know, because that's a different violence. Then, you know, if you're
what's sclerotic,
you become ossified, so to speak.
Yeah, I've never heard that term.
Yeah. By the way, are you recording already?
I am. Yeah.
No. All right.
That's okay.
Hey,
yeah, go ahead.
How's it going with Prisoner of Infinity? Is it going okay for you? Are you getting some sales in, or?
I only can gauge that via Amazon, and that's pretty conflicted, because I feel that Amazon probably is the worst place to promote it and so on, but it's pretty hard to resist using it as a gauge, you know, just to check in.
It's probably impossible, yeah.
Yeah, more or less. And certainly if I get reviews there and want to read them, I'm pleased, and I want people to review it somewhere, and that seems to be the logical place. But anyway, I haven't checked with my publishers. It seems to be selling better than previous books. I mean, Seen and Not Seen is not a point of comparison, because that just disappeared without a trace in terms of, you know, the world at large. And but even compared to, you know, other books, I would say it's probably selling a little bit better. But who knows, you know, compared to what?
Fair enough. But you know what? I think it's a brilliant book, and I was, we had this, it wasn't so easy to get this review published for whatever reason, right?
Yeah.
And there was something that resisted it almost.
Yeah.
Maybe not consciously, but it was interesting, because for me it was also a part of, for myself, to make justice in the world is to help other talent that I think is, needs to be read, and I think this book is brilliant, so I wanted to sort of contribute to that.
I appreciate that.
Perhaps that's the bridge to Jordan Peterson, who's your who I remember you wanted to talk about him, and I kind of want to talk about him too,
Oh, okay.
because hey, that's that's trendy, and I don't know like how many podcasts you've had about this, but I definitely thought it was such an interesting phenomenon, and I really enjoyed the articles you wrote about him too. Very, very measured and level-headed.
Good, well, thanks. And yeah, I wasn't sure because you didn't respond, so I wasn't sure how much interest you have in him or awareness in him. And I'm like everything I do, I suppose, in two minds about how much attention to give him. And specifically in terms of the podcast, I was wondering that. Like, there's been a series now of basically talking about him, and I'm wondering. I have wondered, about regular listeners, many of whom had never heard of Jordan Peterson before I brought him to their attention, which I'm somewhat ambivalent about. But anyway, I'm trusting that it doesn't matter. Like with Strieber, you weren't familiar with Strieber, but he
No,
presents
yeah,
a sufficiently
it's
interesting
true.
case study. That it's not that relevant, really, and I think the same can be true with Peterson. I mean, certainly the thing that really got my wife's attention, which then got my attention, wasn't it was it was at least 50% something other than Peterson himself, as in the cultural response to Jordan Peterson and how unprecedented it seemed to be. So.
It's totally interesting to me too. I feel even, it's interesting because the last time we talked was what there was more than a year ago, right? And it really feels like culture has changed a lot ever since. And I wrote an essay about in part about Peterson for Jacobite magazine at the beginning of the year. I do check it out. I mean, I think it's interesting because it's quite similar because I'm also sort of I think in overall that Jordan Peterson is a very positive phenomenon. Like no, I have no doubt about that. I really think that's that you know that it's a phenomenon of hope, of course. And I saw that the other day somewhere. I thought where somebody made a really interesting point about him, saying that it shows that truth and status are not necessarily disconnected.
Well, so
And I found it,
that's the crux of it. Yeah, go
isn't it? It's interesting,
on.
isn't it? Because of course, yeah, that is the unspoken thing, like because sort of. In this society, you have to sort of status. You have to you have to be a part of the big lie, and perhaps that's especially evident for younger generations who are often too cynical about it. Which is also good because sort of Peterson stabilizes this a bit and says like you can't move into the world with this sort of cynicism. And I find that extremely interesting because that says something about, I mean, in a way that what he does is very much part of, the specific trajectory as well. That must come from someone who was able to sort of preserve his innocence, and you can do this in academia to a certain degree. I don't think. You could do a similar thing in the private sector. I think in the private sector you would face the demons of society much earlier, and perhaps an academic can be naive enough to sort of not see this. And I find that totally interesting because it's so contradictory. There's someone who's dealing with like some of the most intense power knowledge of the 20th century, which is psychology. And psychological testing, sort of directly born out of the worst of Cold War science and World War II science, and has this incredible power knowledge, which is brutal in itself, which is, I think, in part why people are resisting it, you know, sort of this like, okay, he's talking about things like IQ and so on, you know, which is that's terrible stuff, you know, in a way.
Mm.
And all of a sudden, but still sort of maintains in a way his innocence within academia, and from this position sort of speaks to society as someone who's genuinely honest and sort of not corrupted too much by power, at least until now. I mean, and I find that extremely interesting. The other day I was listening to a podcast and there was something similar, and I didn't make this connection initially. It was a woman, a whistleblower of a French bank, who sort of after the financial crisis became a whistleblower. I have to look up her name again. I don't have it in my head right now. And it was a totally interesting story because I heard her talking, and she was in amidst this like a structure of corruption where everybody knew what was going on and sort of talking about it behind, you know, like, you know, making innuendos and references. And she just didn't get it. And once she found out, she was completely devastated. And she became depressed. And then she eventually became a whistleblower. And, you know, like you could argue, of course, you know, perhaps like a part of it was like this sort of, you know, like feminine vanity, you know, that she was really in that position where she said, well, we got awards for our corporate culture, so I thought we were good. Mm-hmm. And everybody else except for her seemed to know exactly what was going on.
Right.
And then so she just never thought about it. And I think that's so interesting to think about this, that there is like there is goodness and naivety, and it's not everything is rigged, even though it seems like this, because there is, you know, so much pathology. If you really open your eyes, you know, it can also be devastating. You can't kind of open your eyes too quickly to these things, you know. You sort of need to grow with the pathology in society. You need to develop an immune system before you can start to criticize it, I think. And I find that's incredible in a way. I've never really thought about it this way.
Hmm. That's quite a lot. It seems that you identifying, I guess, well, with this woman that you mentioned, but then you're comparing the woman to Peterson. It sounds like you're quite identifying with Peterson, at least a particular perspective you have, I would say quite an optimistic one, but anyway, of him as this sort of guileless, semi-innocent or quasi-innocent, who is saying he was quite sheltered in the world of academia and therefore didn't, or maybe still doesn't quite recognize the degree to which society is engineered and pathology, you know, pathological.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you listen to, I mean, at least it seems like this to me, you know, his understanding of politics is like, I mean, I don't know what to say about that, you know. I mean, maybe that's just like, that's this very, you know, like, as a European, you would say that comes from a young nation.
Yeah.
You know, like Canada, they can grow there, like an idea that, you know, like history has, you know, like it has been just, you know, and then looking at sort of this with this, like, you know, television Cold War history, that the Soviet Union was evil and we were good.
Right.
Like, okay, with some concessions maybe, but, you know, it's not looking at it really from the outside. It's not taking into account Vietnam or,
right,
you know, Hiroshima or Fallujah, you know, and I think that's like, to even utter these things, and I'm not entirely sure there if it's not sort of, because Peterson, he's in this very interesting, it's very conflictual in the essence, because he in a way he tries to save the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, but how can he do that without lying?
Yeah.
And it's a very difficult contradiction. And yeah, maybe he's innocent. You know, like sometimes he sounds like an honest guy. And you know, like maybe it, you know, politics is just not his thing or something. You know, I mean, I don't know. And
Well, he's devoted half his life to studying totalitarian governments, by his own claim anyway, and that was what, you know, motivated him, was this fear of totalitarianism, and I think it seems to be still motivating him today. So, but yeah, he seems to have directed the lens, as you say, outside rather than inward. I would say he does not take a psychological approach to things, which I think is ironic and paradoxical, because by profession, he's a psychologist, but the lens he uses seems to be very, very far from a psychological one.
Yeah, I mean, I think propaganda doesn't seem to play a role in his worldview, right? I mean, to even make this claim, sort of to say, oh yeah, everything else is an ideology except for me. You know, and in a way it's funny, and on the other hand, of course he's right, because you know, you need to sort of, it's not so easy to take these things in, you know, without, like, if you relativize everything, then life of course becomes different as again. And he's trying to make you know, sort of a mass compatible philosophy, and of course this is where the trouble starts, right? Because you know, once you try to, you know, like, yeah, once you try to make a thing mass compatible, then you enter sort of the domain of these noble lies and so on, you know, like Leo Strauss, which is like a sort of elite ideology of like everybody else is too stupid for the truth, so we have to prepare it for them. And I don't know, like it's very interesting. I remember myself being in university, and of course, like this sort of postmodernism he presents, it's a caricature, of course. You know, and I think you had a blog post where somebody said, okay, look, that's the difference between Foucault and Derrida. And of course, it's everything is a bit more complex, and I don't really know what to think about this, because on the one hand side, I definitely agree that it's more complex, and I would say, like, remembering from university, I studied social sciences, you know, studied politics, and you know, that's generally like a you know, a thing that's, you know, kind of stupid people study, you know, at least the most people in there, they're not that intelligent, and I could definitely see what was happening. And yeah, I saw that there too, that people took this sort of complex stuff, didn't really read it or understand it. They didn't have the, you know, like even the discipline to read this stuff like in its entirety, and just took like the most essentialist gist out of it. And this thing is, you know, like sort of what we see today as identity politics. So I think there's always this a problem of knowledge gets vulgarized, and then it becomes something entirely different. But then again, you could ask, you know, like, isn't the stuff, you know, like this, you know, like French turgid and convoluted writing, you know, like, isn't that particularly prone to being misinterpreted? And yeah, of course, perhaps that is also true.
Well, I mean, this is an example of a contradiction in Peterson's thinking and evidence of an ideological bias, I'd say, because sure, you can trace the current insanity of identity politics, etc., political correctness. You can locate some of its roots in postmodernism, I think. It seems that you can do that. But to extrapolate from that therefore postmodernism is ipso facto responsible for, you know, or that was where the rot began, let's say. If you're going to apply that sort of reasoning, which isn't entirely unreasonable, but then Peterson also needs to apply it to his supposed wonderful Western individualist system, because that's also the system that has led to the situation we're in too. It's not as though it was just, well, this is how he wants to present it, that postmodernism came in and ruined everything. It's scapegoating, essentially, right? But even if there was, I mean, there's a kernel of truth, but, nonetheless, you can't separate the cancer from the body that generates the cancer. Something's happening in the body that allows the cancer to take a hold there. So you can't separate out the strands of cultural evolution in order to identify, the point at which the disorder began. I mean, God knows I've been trying to do that, and in my writing, and I've always known that you have to go back to the Garden of Eden. I was never naive enough to think you can just go 10, 20, 30 years ago and find, and course correct like that. I knew it went all the way back to the beginning, but even then I couldn't, even then you can't really figure it out. Like Peterson, interesting enough, he does talk about the Bible and Genesis and the Garden of Eden and all that stuff, but he doesn't seem to be, I don't find that he's actually making his different perspectives or the different layers or the different maps of meaning that he's referring to, that he's actually making them congruent or getting them to work together or to actually mesh together in a way that's deeply meaningful, which would be like, well, okay, so let's see the ways in which postmodernism reflects a sort of virus, if you will, a psychic virus that can also be traced back to the Garden of Eden and the mythical thing of original sin and so on. I mean, he doesn't talk about trauma. I guess that's really what I'm going to end up coming down to. And, well, if you're not talking about trauma, then you're not talking about anything, in my view. You're not getting to the root of anything, and psychic fragmentation, and obviously I've just written a book about this and you like the book, and so it's kind of, I feel like this is like a bit, we can,
but I think you still have to see, you have to look at your book in a way and understand that takes strength to read this stuff and to think about it.
Yeah,
it's not obvious. It's not 12 rules for life.
No,
and
for sure.
Readers wouldn't buy it for that, And it's not that's a different approach. You're talking to a different audience.
Yes, but So there is something inherent about trauma and about psychological psychic fragmentation that makes it very, very hard to think about. Like, it's in our body, the resistance to thinking about it, going there, is in our bodies. So absolutely, I mean, it's not coincidental that Prisoner Infinity is my most difficult to read book, because the subject matter itself is forbidding, and I did my best to navigate that. But still, we're talking about...
Well, there's resistance, but I think there's also... Isn't there a trauma theory that sort of, traumatized people try to... don't you write about that, they also want to re-experience?
Yeah, reenactment compulsion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Reenactment, yeah. Mm. No, I mean, of course...
Well, the thing is if you're not... going, I mean, this is a psychological principle. If you're not, it isn't either or, but to the extent that we're not actually letting ourselves see the problem, then we're confabulating narratives that will prevent us from seeing it. It's an either or that's also a spectrum. So then, this is the whole thing about crucial fictions. And so Peterson, he's a psychologist, he's a clinical psychologist, he knows about post-traumatic stress disorder because he writes about it in his 12 steps, 12 rules. It's not like he completely, keeps it off the table. And it's not like he wouldn't understand the subject, or he wouldn't agree that if somebody presented it to him and said, well, look, what about trauma? How central is this to... the situation that we're addressing here in terms of identity confusion and social destabilization and so forth. He's going to have to acknowledge that. But some part of him has chosen to de-emphasize that. And you say he doesn't seem to know about propaganda, he doesn't seem to factor in. So then he could, even less is he going to consider mind control. Of what, of any variety, whether
Although, if you
domestic
think about it, right, I mean, it wouldn't be absurd for him to not to know about that, right? Because he's been with the big institutions, like this, a lot of this stuff happened in Canada too, right, with the psychological institutions. So,
yeah. Well, he went
yeah.
to McGill, which is where Ewan Cameron was studying. So he's a student of McGill. He's very closely. His trajectory runs very close to MK Ultra,
Yeah.
to the
Although,
point
I
that,
mean,
yeah.
in a way, it would make also, like, rationally, it would make sense to talk about it because he's sort of, like, if you think about it, he's a prophet of, individualism and individual empowerment, and also about what's good about this, which is, like, to sort of look to the future and sort of, escape the determinisms of the past. And well, that's a, I mean, you probably know that that's a difficult thing to navigate, that to sort of, you need to, like, sort of acknowledge the past, but, like, without indulging in it. And I th th that's not a that's not an that's not an easy thing to master, which I guess, again, like, comes back to something. I mean, I think he's a fatherly figure, so in a way, he, in a way, has to create a sort of youth psychology, right?
Well,
I
he doesn't
mean,
have to, but that seems to be
no,
what's
he doesn't. He
happening.
do, he, do, he doesn't have to, but, like, let's say in th that is that has sort of become de facto his role. Like, he's become, sort of a, yeah. He's addressing himself a lot to a cynical younger generation, and in that way, I'm very forgiving to Peterson for his shortcomings, because I think, like in general, probably two things, like because just, I think in general, his aesthetic is so subversive. It's to come together and to mainstream long talks, like, about complex subject matter. That in itself seems to me to be, like, like, subversive in its very nature, because that's, like, opposing this sort of soundbite civilization where everything keeps getting reduced. And that people engage with long and complex content, I think, in itself, that's a positive outcome in itself, even if nothing else comes from this. And the second thing is that, well, he says, he said something like, yeah, sort of, speak truth to the world and be courageous. And don't just accept the pathology around you. And I think that's the second thing that is, yeah, if like, whatever follows from this, like, he's not going to save the world by himself in a way, or make it better. But, somebody who says that is going to be problematic to this sort of pathological power, I think. Because if he inspires a couple of other people to sort of do the same thing and say, oh, okay, no, he drew a line in the sand. I find that really interesting, and it was necessary.
is it fair? Is it fun? Is it rare? Is it done? Is it swell? Is it fear? Is it hell? Is it queer? Caught me like kids, kids in Africa. Fair, is it fun? Is it rare? Is it done? Is it swell? Is it fear? Is it hell? Is it queer? Caught me like kids.
Well, who was it necessary to, do you think?
Well, I'm very much in agreement with this. I understand this sort of outrage against this culture of fear, which people call political correctness.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a slightly different theory about it. I don't think it's like sort of, I think to look at it and to say, oh, that's just, you know, like the stupid left who's going completely nuts. I think that's too easy. I think for me that is censorship via the left.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sort of the you have your useful idiots, and this is how you implement censorship in a society. And
mm-hmm.
and censorship from the left is called political correctness or hate speech or whatever. And the censorship from the right is, of course, national security. And, you know, we're a bit more familiar with that, you know, like people who've,
mm-hmm.
you know, like sort of looked at politics ever since 9/11. But, you know, like, and they both have their sort of proponents. And in the case of the, in the case of the left, of course, it nonetheless, it becomes something, you know, cult-like and weird. And I can see how that must be particularly evident at U.S. universities. I mean, I've only seen some videos of campuses, and, you know, like, just like the level of hysteria and the way people are screaming at these demonstrations. I mean, I don't think that whatever postmodernism or political correctness is responsible for those things, but I mean, it's certainly like one of the unpleasurable outcomes and like ugly things. I really think that there's a like an aura of ugliness surrounding these things.
Yeah, well, I would agree, and certainly that was why Peterson first appealed to me, along with apparently millions of other people at this point. You know, so that's why I asked, you know, necessary to who? Because was it necessary for Peterson? I mean, that, if so, that seems like a good thing that he did it. If it was truly necessary for him, then good on him, he did it. It wasn't necessary for me to see or hear about somebody else doing that to know that I can do it. I already know that I can do that. Does it make it easier? Maybe it does, or maybe it doesn't. You know, that remains to be seen. But regardless of whatever, you know, the outcome or whatever the positivity of that stance, the fact remains that it was a no, that Peterson was simply saying no to something that anyone in their right mind knows we need to say no to, or they need to say no to, you know, if we're being actually coerced and manipulated into going against what we know is true, then we have to say no to that. That's very basic stuff, not to say that it isn't getting lost. I mean, that's the whole point. People are losing the thread there. But I still, you know, this is really kind of the beginning of my skepticism about Peterson, which I summed up early on, and that's that, as my wife used to say to me, that before you can say yes, you have to say no.
Mm-hmm.
And I understood what she meant, and then I began to really experience it in a way and internalize it, and it became something like a truism. Like, of course, if you haven't learned to say no, then your yes doesn't really have full affirmative power behind it, because sometimes you just say yes because you don't know how to say no, right? So the power to say no really
is really fundamental.
It's really profound. But by the same token, the value of saying no isn't determined by what you say no to, but by what you say yes to thereafter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true too. Yeah,
and what Peterson is saying yes to is something I would also say no to, essentially, which is hierarchies of competence, and that competence is synonymous with virtue. And this he's not actually saying that, but there's an implication there, which and it's, you know, I think it's really central to this blind spot that he has. Something really hard to kind of unpack here, but you said about truth and status, and you know, he speaks to my own complex absolutely in terms of what you said about, you call it cynicism, I would call it paranoia, but the absolute sort of conviction that our culture is set up in such a way that you don't attain status except by lying, as you said, except by being complicit with power abuse, which is the sort of postmodern view that Peterson is challenging. So I have that, and as you probably know and have picked up, that causes a lot of conflict for me, because I'm writing and trying to get recognized while at the same time believing that if I were to be recognized in any major way, it would be evidence that I was somehow being untrue. And so,
yeah, but I don't think necessarily that this is true, or at least even true anymore. And I think I guess to come back to the hopeful element in this is that, in a way, Jordan Peterson and or in general these figures, you know, that other people would probably qualify as whatever gatekeeper opposition or something, you know.
Yeah.
I think they make it possible for me to engage with the mainstream again, and to sort of and I think that's what's needed. You need the sort of confidence to say, I am speaking reasonable things, so therefore I should get a shot at, you know, like engaging with the mainstream. And that doesn't mean become famous, but that means, you know, arguing your case. Rationally arguing your case. So everything that sort of expands this notion of what is accepted in a way and what is alternative truth, you know, like, and complex, that's what I mean by when I'm saying, okay, people are willing to engage with complex content.
Yeah.
That is so valuable in itself, you know, that, of course, you for example, you read Prisoner of Infinity, which is just like, The suppositions, like it's that's a radically disenchanted book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's incredible in that. But at the same time, it's very well argued, and it's beautifully written, and you know, it's humorous. And so why should it not be mainstream in a way? You know, I think you really have to kind of childishly ask that question. You know, why shouldn't you be able to present that to someone, you know, like, you know, to a reasonable human being, and then they, you know, like, and then just engage with them without that, you know, like, you, I think it's easy to become entangled in this little, like, sort of scene of people that you can interact with, and then you sort of become confined to that as well, because you, okay, I don't want to engage with that other stuff anymore, because, you know, like, you become so difficult to argue, and I think in a way that you know it's interesting. Like I wrote about this in this essay for Jacobite Historiography Wars, it's called. This technology, like the internet, you know, where and there's people like Yasha Levine who wrote this really interesting book called Surveillance Valley, who said, okay, that the internet has always been a surveillance tool against like a counterintelligence tool to monitor opposition.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, it has that aspect, but it also it's like every technology also has you know, other collateral effects that are difficult to anticipate. And I think today we have a, you know, technology of decentralization that are so powerful in themselves that, you know, it's just hard to anticipate the effects of these things. You don't know what is coming out of this, you know. So I think there's a lot of opportunity coming up.
Well, yes, I mean, but if you're going to run with that line of reasoning, you have to take it all the way into the postmodern waters, really, of radical relativism, it seems, in a certain sense, and acknowledge we don't know the outcome of anything. You know, we don't know the final outcome, because we're not going to, you know, it's so far off, like, and there is no final outcome, really.
But even that you don't know.
But even that you don't know. I mean, you can only really know what's happening in the moment. So right in the moment, you and I are engaged in a lively, passionate conversation revolved around Jordan Peterson. So we can probably agree that there's been a positive outcome from Jordan Peterson, just in terms of, as you put in a different way, you know, giving us something to sink our teeth into, right? But that's got nothing to do with Jordan Peterson's benevolence or the truth or the meaning of his ministry. Nothing at all, because we could be having the same conversation about Adolf Hitler, what have you, you know. Sorry to use such a lazy example, especially with a German, but, you know, just in terms of...
You know, I've heard that before, Jason.
two separate questions, really, like... What is inherently benevolent, or what is inherently of value, and what can I engage with? I mean, maybe we are looking for a way to make those two things congruent. I don't know. I mean, like, the reason I would engage with Peterson, I hope and I trust and I pretty much know, is because I recognize qualities within myself that I'm still trying to understand better. You know, including the ambition, including the naivety, including the innocence or the ignorance, including the craving for status, you know, including the hubris of wanting to put myself forward as a world teacher, savior. You know, I recognize a complex when I see one, archetypal possession, let's say. And so that's naturally where I'm going to keep wanting to go with Peterson is, okay, we can acknowledge that it's having a positive effect now, but this is very early days, and
yeah of course. But I mean, you never know, sort of. I mean, it's very, you know, like, you're absolutely right, and perhaps you know, that's this weird aspect of it. You know, we live in a world where we share this, like, incredible power knowledge, you know, like that Peterson shares, like this, you know, like, sort of, you know, crazy psychological experiments from the 20th century that reveal human beings in a way that, you know, like, exposes them as completely manipulable, in essence. And yeah, we don't know what's going to come out of this, and especially when this, you know, like, Peterson seems to be like a sort of balanced guy with, you know, like a lot of ambiguity and, you know, level-headed, let's say, and now he passes this knowledge on to much younger people who are at different positions in their life. And that's interesting, right? Because what's going to happen now is that, you know, like, they have these incredible power tool knowledges, and we have no idea what they're going to do with them.
Right.
You know, and I think it seems to me to be in general that, like, the way of the internet, that, you know, like, these, you know, like, knowledge that takes a lot of immune system is rapidly shared. You know, and that's what people on the online call the red pill, right? Like, you get red pilled. It's like shock. It's like, you know, this medical pharmaceutical metaphor for you ingest something, and you know, then you have to cope with it. And sort of like the medication, of course, it's like, you know, you can overdose on knowledge too. You know, you don't know how you're going to react to a knowledge. You know, you need to also cultivate a you know, like, strong enough body and mind to deal with a medication and not become a drug addict, or poison yourself, and so on. So,
yeah
I mean, we have no idea what's happening, but I think still at this point in time, given the way culture was and is drifting, perhaps, I think it was necessary. And perhaps it was as necessary as postmodernism was at a certain point to sort of, create something new out of this like stale Marxism that was like ultimately deterministic. And in the end, then it becomes like something absolutely pathological and horrible. we don't know that, but I think, at the time, and if you look at also just the mass of things this guy says, like in a very comprehensible way, hours and hours of public speaking, which I think you identified that as well. I think that's his true strength over writing. I think he's a much better speaker than a writer too. And I think that in itself, just also to see someone and to see, okay, that is somebody who's actually, you ask him a question and he doesn't have an answer already prepared.
Mm-hmm.
He's actually engaging with what you think. And to me, that's extremely subversive practice, because that is like really like people engaging with each other seriously, man. That hasn't happened for a while, man. I mean, I don't know what you think about this, but I'm a child of this sort of generation of sound bites and mass media prepared things and
mm-hmm.
that just didn't happen.
Did you watch the Monk debate?
Which one was that?
It was a recent one with Peterson and Stephen Fry, and on one side about political correctness, and then on the other side with this guy Dyson and this woman. I don't remember.
Yeah,
it was...
I've seen that. That's probably already where it's degenerating.
Right? Yeah, that was my point. Thanks for getting there right away.
Yeah.
And there's something about the Peterson phenomenon, which is that people are, besides the large demographic that is sort of gathering a kind of cult-like following around him,
mm-hmm.
that there's this whole probably equally large and equally devoted faction that is identifying in opposition, has a negative identification.
Oh my God,
And so this
strong reactions. Jesus, I'm so surprised at how they react so strongly to this.
Me too.
Sorry, go on.
Yeah, well, I notice it myself. Like if I speak to somebody who's really in favor of Peterson or really loves him, I feel quite hostile towards Peterson, whereas if I'm talking with somebody who hates the guy, then I feel quite defensive of him. So, I mean, that's
you're a bit compulsively subversive.
Well,
do you know that,
or just negative identity? Identifying whatever. I don't know how subversive it is. I think in its best. The best aspect of this in myself is this liminal thing, which is the desire to bridge irreconcilable points of view, to actually reconcile the irreconcilable, and to create or discover a place where we can remain ambiguous, we can allow for ambiguity to exist and not knowing. And
that's interesting. I mean, hey, I see that. I see that. Exactly, in myself too, but that's why for me Peterson is beneficial, because it's sort of like it's more reconciliation as well.
Well, yeah, but
because like I have this like tendency I'm looking for the faults in things a lot, I think, and that makes me an interesting thinker, but it's not always in my favor, also to,
well, I know. To, I mean, yeah,
so,
yeah.
As somebody who's also trying to structure a life, and
yes. Well, I mean, in my case, it's turned out that the life I structured was around very mundane activities, such as sorting women's clothes and people's junk and selling it and passing it on and renovating my house and stuff. And I think. This is not getting to the point that I wanted to get to, but maybe I will. But speaking to this one now, that this goes back to your point about the mainstream, and that You know, me working in a thrift store on the, you know, the high street of the town I lived, that's the mainstream. In terms of actually wanting to be at the centre or even close to the margin of the centre of the mainstream debate on the internet, which is the whole world, I think that that's a fantasy that, although it might not be impossible to realise, well, number one, I don't think I would really enjoy it if I could. I think I'd get some sort of gratification that I was being validated as relevant to the collective debate, but I wouldn't really believe that validation, you know? Because of what I know, that once the mainstream begins to validate you, then the mainstream has perceived you as useful for reinforcing its own mainstream narrative. That's just the nature of the beast as I see it. I don't see that as cynicism, and I don't see it as paranoid. I see it as a sort of meta understanding, or an understanding of the metaphysics of the collective social structures, I would say. And but anyway, maybe I can bring this back to the point I was trying to get to, which was Peterson. And I think that he's a polarizing presence. I think he's the opposite of a reconciliatory presence. And because I don't think you can, it's tempting to want to put all the responsibility on his opponents who come up for this debate, and instead of debating, they attack him, right? So it's very easy to just put the blame on them and see Peterson as, you know, he's just honestly trying to present some difficult truths, but these stupid leftists keep sabotaging it, right? But, you know, it's not, I mean, life isn't like that, really. It's always a collaboration, you know, when two intelligences meet. And Peterson, however he's done it, and I suspect unconsciously, he's established himself in the mainstream as an oppositional presence who triggers, in quotes, people, who, you know, pushes their buttons, who puts people on the defensive. And so he evokes this kind of hostility out of people. And that creates polarization. And that actually prevents the very debate. You see, I definitely know what you're talking about with Peterson. Like, he listens and he responds, and he does seem to want to model as well as preach that way of being in the world. But the more I've listened to him, the less I feel he's really doing that. Like, he's doing it more than your average mainstream speaker, for sure. Like, he does show that he's not just got a scripted answer the whole time, and he does seem to stop and think, and he does say, well, I don't know, or I can't ask. He does the sort of externals of it, but I'm not sure it's that different from a politician like Trump, who's just learned a few new tricks and learned that, yeah, actually people are sick of the whole scripted thing. They want a joker in the pack, you know. I'm not sure it's really that far removed from that, because as far as I've seen, when Peterson does start getting too close to difficult terrain, chaos, as he would put it, he brings out an anecdote, or he brings out a model. He brings out his model, right? And he says, well, if you want to talk about this, first I have to talk for 10 minutes about this. And basically, you have to understand my whole worldview, you know, before I can answer that question. He has a tendency to do that.
Yeah, there was a moment in the monk debate where it's just like, you know, it's like the Holocaust, and you know, and that was supposed to stand for everything that, you know, like it's just easy distinction of, you know, like. I have a special sensitivity for that, because, you know, like, as a German, that's, you know, what you're taught with, sort of, you know, and sort of everything you do wrong is potentially the Holocaust,
right?
You know, so and I think this is where, you know, like, rational debate ends. So I was quite disappointed with him in that, and I think that's the worst side of his, when he's leaving his, like, I think genuinely honest and interesting project of sort of, you know, like, mythical structures. You have to give it to him, like maps of meaning, just these concepts. That's very genuine. You know, it's very original and idiosyncratic the way he sort of tries to understand the whole world. I mean, just like the magnitude of this project is, it's absolutely baffling. Mm-hmm. And it's crazy. And then you really have this, like, yeah, the, this, like, I don't know, Cold War television politics.
Mm-hmm.
It's really, I don't know what to make of it, really. It's strange.
There's a song about a flood watch.
All up, we've broken all our place for you. All up, we wished into the willows for your good, but we hear struck by the lack of you.
Well, I think it, I mean, it's probably in his model as well, because it's like the context. It's like that's his low resolution map, is this fear of totalitarianism, fear of gulags, fear of nuclear destruction. That his whole project is geared towards avoiding something terrible. And that, okay, so.
Yeah, interesting, yeah, okay.
Because that's, there's two ways to look at that, at least. One is politically, as you say, so it's all framed in this ideological framework which says that totalitarianism is bad, our kind is good. But then also psychologically, that it's all couched in this psychological avoidance strategy, let's say, which, well...
Yeah, it's tricky, yeah, absolutely, I agree, yeah. You the more you avoid something,
The more you make it necessary to happen, and that's I think, come back to a point I wanted to get back to, where you said about Peterson being necessary. I would agree. He's emerged as some sort of necessary response to the cultural climate. The guy who says no to bullshit, and that's very gratifying to see that. But
in the incarnation of a dialectic, in a way, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the thing is that, I mean, I don't think it's coincidental that that kind of necessary response, culturally necessary, leads to, it increases polarization rather than reconciles it. Like, his whole thing is about trying to reconcile consciously. But as he himself has said, the psychological maxim, if you want to know what somebody's about, don't listen to what they say they believe or what they're trying to do. Look at the effects of what they're doing.
Look at the effects, that's what he says.
Well, I'm not quoting him, but he has referred to that basic psychological maxim, which is that you can't trust what a person says about what they believe or what they're doing or what they're trying to achieve. You just have to look at how they act and what the consequences of their actions are, because the unconscious is so much greater than our conscious rationales ever can be. So, and our embodiment is what really counts. Actions speak louder than words. Well, you see, for me, Peterson, and this is a, you know, it's a delicate area for me, because it does trigger me that the guy is hugely successful. There's no doubt about it. It pisses me off, along with loads of other people, you know. I'm not alone in that. You're right.
I think a lot of people are not, you know.
No. Yeah. So, but, you know, I still think that I can, because I can see that in my reactions, I think I'm also able to see beyond them. And what I see in Peterson, and I also notice it particularly when I listen to his audios, or listen to his presentations, just audio, and I was just hearing his voice, I was quite surprised by what kind of information I felt I could read in his voice. And the overall, you know, my sense of Peterson more and more is that he's not embodying the principles that he's preaching. He's saying one thing, but he's doing another. And that I know it's a big statement, and I would have to back it up with lots of different things, but I'm just bringing it up now because of that would also relate to this context of a person who preaches or presents certain ways of proceeding, but the results of what they're actually attempting to do are the opposite of what they say they are. That would relate to the fact that the medium and the message aren't congruent, and so people are responding not to what Peterson or whoever is saying, but to the way he's saying it and why he's saying it.
Yeah, I mean, perhaps, like, I think there's definitely something interesting. It's interesting what you say to me, like that. Okay, that's in his voice, for example, and because I've noticed that as well. And I think that part of what is interesting about him is that he's very, like, fragile physically, isn't he?
Well, he's thin, yeah.
And in a way, I find that interesting because, perhaps it would be now a good time for him to withdraw from public debate.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think maybe in his mind he's already, like, going down the way of sort of, like, sacrificing himself,
yeah.
You know, sort of taking on too many engagements. And I think you can sort of hear that, because sometimes he sounds really weak and he must have an insane schedule and so on.
Yeah.
And
Right. So consciously.
Sorry, I'm thinking while I'm speaking, because I think it's very, very interesting observation about the voice. And you also have this phenomenon that, of course, you know, power corrupts and vulgarizes and reinforces you to a degree that is perhaps unhealthy. But, you know, like, I mean, this guy, you know, like, you can definitely think I think that he is honest about, you know, sort of his perceptions, and that he genuinely questions himself. And I think that he would at least he'll take into account the effects of his power if given enough time, you know. But maybe that's also part of the curse of the structural determinations of power, that all of a sudden you don't own your time anymore.
Yeah, I think so. I think there is something quite new about Peterson, in that I think that the structures of cultural control, let's say, are sufficiently developed now that it's possible for a seemingly spontaneous phenomenon to emerge without it presenting a threat to those structures, because it will just naturally get pulled into the behaviors that are guaranteed to compromise it, let's say, as opposed to in the past it's been set up that individuals have to be compromised before they're given a level of influence in society to make sure that they can be handled, you know, and redirected if they're having the wrong effects, you know, the undesirable effects. That's how it's been set up, I think, anyway. But then with the internet, of course, there are different ways now to become successful, and Peterson is perhaps the first kind of YouTube superstar, the first person to graduate from YouTube celebrity to actual mainstream celebrity. So there does seem to be an element there that at least isn't being controlled via the, you know, the previous channels that are becoming more and more recognized by, in fact, the internet YouTube culture, which is so paranoid and cynical. Right, so it has had to adopt and mutate to survive, I think, as in, you know, cynical new generations who don't believe in mainstream figures anymore, they can feel that they're choosing their leaders, and they're making them successful, and to some extent they are, but the apparatus is set up in such a way that, as you say, power corrupts. I mean, that's not part of the apparatus, that's part of the human psyche, really. That goes so deep.
But because the
hierarchies of power are such that they intoxicate us, you know, this is what I think is Peterson's blind spot, that he will tell himself, and I would do the same, I'm sure. So this isn't meant as a, you know, it is a criticism, but I'm not saying that I or anyone is any different. He will tell himself that he has to make hay while the sun shines. He must seize this opportunity in order to, you know, reach as many people as possible, because there's so much at stake. Like he's trying to restabilize society and prevent the next whatever it is, right? He'll tell himself that, but there's another part of him that he won't be acknowledging, which is, you know, beneath the threshold of consciousness, which is becoming so I don't know what the word is, whether it's empowered or gratified or reassured by the amount of validation he's getting. That's basically feeding on that constant validation.
But that thing hasn't played out yet. You know, I think you're right. Like this is what happens with power, but you know, at the same time, that's not some 25-year-old kid that's coming into the situation.
You said he's quite innocent. I mean, you pointed out.
Perhaps there's an ambiguity of this sort of innocence too, right? Like there is a part of him that is very innocent, but on the other hand side, you see that he's thought a lot about the human psyche.
Well, I think and, ignorance is a better word than innocence, you know, because I think innocence does protect in these situations. Innocence has to do with being childlike and not driven by sort of social goals or status. Children don't care about status. I mean, at a certain point they learn, but let's say, you know, the more innocent a person is, the less they care about status. I'd say there's a definite correlation there. I forgot what I was going to say now, but it was about the difference between innocence and ignorance, and that, like,
I can at least see we're both thinking while we're talking.
Absolutely, which is a good thing, but
which shows we're not a master rhetoricians. Look, Jason, yeah, that no world fame for you without that. You know, you're gonna have to
avoiding becoming unfinished sentences. You mean?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, you see, but if we'd been live, I would have just kept going. But I don't want to. I know ways to continue what I was saying, but there's something here that is, I mean, that's the whole reason to talk about it. There's something here that we don't understand.
I know why you're sort of, it's enigmatic, you know. I don't know what to make of it either. Like, I have no idea, and I think, but you know, and at the same time, we're going to see it play out, probably. You know, there's a good chance that, you know, we'll see what's happening with this. And I've seen the monk debate, you've seen the monk debate, and it represents a certain, it's definitely, you know, like taking it a step lower.
I think it's inevitable. I think there's something about our culture that we can actually look back at previous examples, that there are these windows of opportunity in which something is emerging, and you can see it, and you can benefit from it, but the culture gathers around it very quickly and then imitates it and replicates it, and then it just gets becomes part of that replicated thing. And although Jordan Peterson will still be Jordan Peterson, he already is surrounded by all these sort of responses to Jordan Peterson, which are either imitating him or they're opposing him. Either way, it's become part of this larger Borg-like phenomenon that is Jordan Peterson. And you're right, the best thing he could do, but I think it's too late now, would have been to back off and just say, okay, I don't need another bestseller, I don't need more validations, I don't need more YouTube followers, you know, when is enough enough? And the only reason he could, I think, I shouldn't presume as much, but the only reason I can imagine that he would talk himself out of that is because he feels he has a mission and it's important.
I think so too. I think so too. And I think there's this like sacrificial element, you know, like that. And I think that's perhaps what he's heading for, because I would imagine that his health might be failing with that schedule at some point, you know, and and also that he's aware of this, and that he's sort of, you know, like perhaps also like sort of consciously or unconsciously seeking this sort of spectacle.
Right. So that was where I was.
Perhaps also perhaps also where things go wrong, you know. You have to respect the principles of life in a way too.
Well, the moment, you know, is respecting the moment, because it's not about building something. I mean, if you're trying to build something, you're not living in the moment, to use a horrible cliche, and it's become a horrible cliche, but you're not responding to the moment, never mind living in it. But you know, what does the moment require of us, or what is the moment inviting us into each moment? That's kind of the opposite of building, which is all about, well, how can I, and this is one of Peterson's principles, how can I use this moment to build something for the next moment, this future orientation, right? So, and it just, more and more, I know that it's not worth it. Like, there's no future moment, no matter how glorious, that's worth sacrificing the present to.
Yeah, I don't necessarily agree with that. I think there is you need to find a balance, because, you know, there is this sort of Eastern philosophy of the now, and the Western philosophy of the you know, very vulgarized, the Western philosophy of the, you know, the future, sort of this Christian duality and sort of mission. And I think if, you know, like, you're too much in this now, it's also, you know, the now needs to be structured by the future without being obsessed by it, because if not, then, you know, like, you enter into this world of relativity, which is also, you know, in its own way chaotic. And yeah, I guess those are those, you know, like, you know, even yin yang forces, sort of, which I think is totally interesting. I really like this yin yang concept. The more I understand it, and so I wouldn't necessarily agree with that. I think there is something healthy about, you know, like the you know, individualism, individual responsibility.
But that's it. That's what I'm talking about, ability to respond.
Yeah.
And that can't happen if our attention is not on the present. We can't respond, because we can only respond to what's happening in the present. Like, if we're thinking, how should I act that will create a better future, then we're
already... Of course, No, that's the compulsive mind. You're never there. You're always...
So I think, I mean, because what I didn't, where I got stuck with the innocence and ignorance thing was to do with this innocence being the in the momentness, and the Peterson, if he's driving himself to complete some mission, even if that involves his own self-sacrifice, that I don't think that would be out of innocence. I think that would be out of ignorance. As in being ignorant that well, to the nature of the battle that he's taking on, right? He's not going to change the direction of the whole, you know, of millennia of social engineering just because he happened to get lucky via YouTube, right? This is, he doesn't have, from what he said, he doesn't have sufficient awareness of the social and political structures to really embark upon some kind of salvational mission. I don't think anyone ever would.
He doesn't, but at the same time, you know, like he, you know, like there's something that, you know, in between that he puts forth, and I don't think it's not nothing, you know, like I think he also comes at a time, you know, like where in a way all of these like personas, they emerge right now, you know. I mean, I think something really weird has happened. Like, you know, Alex Jones, right?
Yeah.
And in a way, didn't you find that interesting that all of a sudden, like, there seemed to be, I remember a time when this sort of conspiracy sphere was completely separate from the mainstream.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, these things, they have become sort of intermingled. Like, all of a sudden, Alex Jones has become like a policy man.
Yeah.
And conspiracy at the same time has entered into even government. You know, there's people who say, like, oh, look at Steve Bannon and Donald Trump. They're conspiracy theorists. Because, I mean, in a way, we know that because we know these things are, you know, they're basically distribution of, you know, like information. So these things are intimately tied together. You know, like it's always this internal question of who knows what. And I think we live in a time where this is perhaps, you know, a lot of things are uncertain, a lot of things are remapped. Whether you like Trump or not, you have to admit that the US elite is in a state of disarray, and that has certain effects on the world.
Well, which it depends if we've identified them, though, by the US elite. I mean, elite presumes that they're the highest strata, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, you know, like politicians sort of, they are representatives of certain interests. And these interests, I think they can disagree. And yeah. I think this is what is happening, you know. Like, I mean, I'm not saying, you know, like, I don't believe that, you know, I don't have this naive idea of the world that, you know, like, this sort of phantasm politics where, you know, like Donald Trump is almighty and Hillary Clinton too. No, they represent different parts of an elite, but also different ways of going about. And but then they're also not all powerful, you know. Like you're talking about, like, what is a state apparatus? State apparatus is also staffed with employees, and they're not all ill-willed and evil-meaning, you know, like they have their own set of beliefs. And I think that's something, you know, like these things, they have their own sort of inertia. And you can feel that there is disarray in the US elite because, you know, the rest of the world, like, sort of, perhaps you don't feel that as much in North America. I don't know about that. But in Europe, you definitely feel it. There is a waning of U.S. influence.
Mm-hmm.
And I think everywhere else too. And so I think, you know, these things are, I don't have this vision of the world where everything is predetermined and, you know, like everything is just a manifestation of elite scheming and power.
No.
In a way it is, but, you know, like elites also, they're not, you know, like monadic. It's not one thing. It's like different groups fighting with each other, and, you know, like you, and that manifests itself in the world in different ways.
Well, that's why I asked about, you know, the strata. It depends what strata we're talking about, because I think I see it more as almost like natural forces that move very, very slowly. So, yes, there's lots of variations down at the micro level, but that iceberg is still going to end up at, you know, over on this continent in the end, because it's moving, you know, the the laws of physics that are determining its motion are indifferent to what's going on at a more microcosmic level. Doesn't affect the movement of the masses themselves. That tends to be my view. It's not exactly that it's predetermined, or maybe I'm just splitting hairs, but I mean, it depends what your point of view is. Like, you know, the sun will burn out at a more or less predetermined time, and therefore all life on Earth will end at a more or less predetermined time. So that's a pretty large context, right? And you could say, well, there's all kinds of free will and variations going on in the meantime, but do they really change the outcome? No, not really. Yeah. All life on Earth dies the same date, regardless of all the, you know, best laid plans of transhumanists. I don't know that for a fact, of course. They might.
Yeah, but I mean, yes and no, but because that's not, you know, like I think it's in that case it is all about the nuance.
Yeah.
Because I don't think, you know, like you're not going to avoid hierarchies, or not anytime soon, and you're not going to avoid large states and, you know, like accumulations of techno capital, you know, like, and intelligence and so on. That's impossible. But,
well, that's my point, I think, is that
I don't think that's a realistic goal in a way.
Exactly.
You know, but you can sort of, you know, it's about the nuance of structuring this in a way that is not too terrible, you know, like, and
well, structuring what though?
The sort of accumulations of power.
What you mean in your life or in the whole of society?
In the whole of society, but yeah. I mean, perhaps you can draw that down to your own life.
Yeah, start with your room, Nicholas.
Yeah, of course. I have. It's all clean. Oh God, great! Hey, Jason. I have a meeting in the city very soon, but it was great talking to you.
Oh, you have to go.
Yeah, I have to go. But I.
Oh well, at least we we ended where we began, anyway. So.
yeah. Exactly. That's I also took that as a clue.
Right. All right. Well, that was a lively conversation. Definitely, it seems like we could have gone on for another couple of hours with that. So we can do a follow up if you want, and then it'd be a two parter if you wanted.
Yeah. Well, perhaps we let the conversation sink in for a bit.
Okay.
And then we can, because I think there's a lot, and also see how things evolve. You know, it's going to be interesting.
Mm-hmm. As the Chinese say.
What do they say? As things evolve, or
no? They say, "May you live in interesting times." It's a Chinese curse. I thought everyone knew that now. It's become a cliche.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
May you live in interesting times.
May you live in interesting times. Ah, yeah. Okay. Yeah, that sounds like a curse.
Okay, that's it for my conversation with Nicholas Hausdorff, and that's it for this week's The Liminalist. Not sure what's going on, really. Things have been going on that will be revealed in a future podcast a couple of weeks from now. Certainly captured my attention, and that seems to have coincided with a slackening off of interest in the Jordan Peterson project on both sides, I'd say, your side and my side. Like, there hasn't been any comments or feedback, and I'm just kind of, it feels like yesterday's fish really wrapped in yesterday's paper. Of course, I've got all this material actually still written about Peterson, so imagine eventually it'll see the light of day, but perhaps not right now. I'd like to, if possible, or if it seems appropriate, to have a twice weekly meetup on a more regular basis with the listeners and readers who wish to be participants, who want to pass through the permeable fourth wall audience performer and just participate in dialogues or group meetings. If there is enough interest, I actually do it with just two other people I did last time, but I like to have it on a more formal basis with donations and whatnot. So once again, if you are interested, let me know, otherwise I don't. Alright, that's it. Thanks for listening. This is Jason Horsley at The Liminalist, the podcast between horticulture.com. Oh, and thanks to the donators for donating. Please keep it coming if you can.